This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Falinski.
And Jennifer Renee.
Deborah Bell.
And Glenn Holt.
And on tonight's show, we're going to be speaking with representatives from LOAF, Lesbians Over Age 50. That organization provides support in social activities and celebrates a special anniversary this year. Also, Tom Zeppelin was voted the best massage therapist in Houston in the Outsmart magazine. He will share with us some health benefits of massage. And then in the second hour, J.D. Doyle is going to do his third segment of queer music featuring the transgender's artist. So that all sounds really exciting.
Yes, and on This Way Out tonight, part of the feature is about Kate Clinton, who is, of course, a famous comic, and any fans of Kate should listen in. And we're going to get the representatives from LOAF in, and we'll have an interview with them in just a moment. I think that's part of the headphone that broke. Well, we're back with representatives from Lesbians Over Age 50. Some of them are way over 50. I was told that the average age is between 50 and 87. Is 87 the oldest member now?
Arden? Right. Currently, yes.
Okay, and let's introduce everybody on the panel.
Dusty West, age 69.
Arden Eversmeyer, age 76.
Margaret Thibodeau, age 61.
Charlotte Avery, age 77.
And Deborah Bell, age 58 on my next birthday in January. Because I, too, am a member of Lesbians Over Age 50. As soon as I turned 50, I joined. And Arden, I know you're the founder, so why don't you tell us a little bit about how LOAF came about and what the mission of the group is?
Well, LOAF came into being because my partner of 33 years died when I was about 54. And in order to find community, which at my age at that time was very scarce, it was an effort to create a situation where I could network and find women my age to have a social life with. And the mission of LOAF is pure and simple, social networking and support system for lesbians and their partners 50 years of age or older.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of ironic that the name is LOAF, because you do anything but.
And we're pretty active.
So why don't some of you share some of the things that LOAF has done and how it operates? What goes on? I mean, it's just a bunch of old lesbians hanging out all the time?
Well, we have a meet and greet every third Sunday of the month. And just bring a little something to eat, and we play cards, or we watch movies, or watch sports. Imagine lesbians watching sports.
The concept boggles my mind.
Yes, yes. And every once in a while we have a social activity. One of our social activities recently was to go as a group and visit Forbidden Gardens.
Which is, what?
The Chinese gardens out in Katy, which were the replicas of the Peking Palace and the soldiers of Qi.
So is there a social activity every month?
Every month.
And how does that work? Do different members take turn hosting it? Or
correct, and they can determine what the activity would be it a potluck or... August, we're having an old-fashioned ice cream social.
Yeah, I already put that on my calendar. what are some of the benefits of being in LOAF? What you donate to become a member, right? It's mm-hmm. a donation only. And about how many people are in the group now?
Probably around 200 right now.
Wow. Who knew there were that many old lesbians?
Oh, there's a lot.
And so how do you get the word out?
Well, we have a monthly newsletter. Our mail out is 138 women receive our mail out newsletter. It gives activities that the women in the community might be interested in and other women's issues.
And then there's also a Yahoo group that people can join, and they can be updated on what is on the calendar, as well as when it's someone's birthday or other activities that are going on that lesbians over age 50 might be interested in that aren't necessarily LOAF events, per se. So are all the people retired?
I'd say probably 50% of them are still working. And we're also about 50% single and the rest coupled, so it's not a situation where either a single or a coupled woman would be uncomfortable.
Yeah, and you're going to make friends whether they're in couples or single.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah. And who are the women in LOAF other than they reach the age of 50 and they're lesbian, self-identified as lesbian? Tell me a little bit more about...
Well, there are women coming out of marriages. They've been married, raised their families, and just now getting in touch with their sexuality. And so they come and find other women and just...
We have a lot of women who've lost their partners recently, and they need a support system and another way to kind of keep from being so isolated.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that LOAF provides is as we age and health issues arise, I know we've lost some members over the years.
Yes.
And then as people have needs, they need a support system in place. Sisters can't do it all.
Right.
LOAF members often come in and help their sisters within the group.
That's correct.
Yeah. And stay updated if someone's in the hospital or recovering from something, or maybe they've taken a trip and want a traveling companion, or I saw recently someone was looking for someone to kayak with them. So who knew?
I think right? She found somebody to kayak, too.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. Are there women that have had problems, like with drug or alcohol, that come to LOAF for support? Or?
Well, I think that we probably have several women who are active in AA. I'm sure we may not know about it, but I'm sure that maybe there has been some other kind of substance abuse along the way for some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's why they come. I think they come for the social networking. But it is a good support system for women.
Yeah, and we're drug and alcohol free in our meetings, non-smoking
mm-hmm.
in our meetings. So it's a clean atmosphere.
And that's important, someone that's in recovery, to be in an environment like that.
That's correct.
And that the newsletter and the email group, but how else do you let people know about LOAF?
Pretty much always been word of mouth.
when you started it, you actually started it with a younger woman, right?
Actually, there were six on the committee that brainstormed and actually gave birth to the organization, and none of them were 50 but me. So, but they had connections in the community that I had not, because mm-hmm. I had been fairly closeted, and so I just didn't have the knowledge or the connections. So it took those younger women to get the job done.
Now, Arden maintains a library and somewhat of an archive, plus you're involved with the Old Lesbians Organizing for Change, and you've done the oral history project of women, some fascinating stories. A lot of young people don't realize what the older people went through, such as, you know, being thrown in mental institutions, or having endured raids, or having to be so closeted, because it then, and I mean, it's still true now, that a lot of people would be in fear of losing their job.
Mm-hmm.
And yet so much has changed, but for a lot of the women in Loaf, they still feel pretty protective of their identity.
That's because they've always lived that way. We're talking about a generation of women that had to, for security, had to be careful, had to be closeted. So you don't get over that, you know, overnight. That doesn't just go away.
Mm-hmm.
We have to work through this coming out, as we have always said, is an ongoing process. So
even when you get to be 70-something.
Oh, hey, you know, every day there's a challenge of some kind, you know, and the fact that some of these women even get to Loaf is a big step.
I asked someone, how did she find Loaf, and she said, out of desperation.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I laughed, but I could understand what she mm-hmm. was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the counselors are recommending Loaf to women who are going in with problems after breakups of long-term relationships or marriages, and they don't know where to turn.
Mm-hmm.
And the counselors are sending them.
Yeah, what?
The therapist.
Yeah. That's a good resource. And now, Arden, you've been there since the beginning. Dusty, how long have you been involved with
Life? Well, when they started, I was not 55. And they had set the age at 55. So I couldn't join because I wasn't quite 55.
We changed it pretty quick, though.
They changed that rule.
Yeah, it started off at lesbian over age 55.
For about a year or two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Margaret, how long have you been involved?
I've been involved. I believe this is going on my fifth year. I didn't join Loaf until I had retired from my job and had plenty of time and to do other things and wanted a social network.
When we were talking before the program, you made a comment that really struck me about something that you get out of Loaf. Can you remember what that was about?
Well, one of the reasons that I like Loaf or came to Loaf is that they're women that are quite a bit older than I am, some of them, and they give me a role model on how to grow older and be active. My own mother died when she was young, and so I didn't have a role model for growing older past the age that I am now. And that's one reason I like Loaf, is they give me a role model on how to be active and maintain a good life.
Mm-hmm. And Charlotte, how long have you been involved?
I was one of the six people at the first meeting in 1987, and Arden and I became partners about a month after that meeting.
Uh-oh. Boy, see, networking, starting groups, it works.
And we're celebrating our 20th anniversary this year.
So it's also the 20th anniversary of Loaf.
Right.
Yes.
And are there any special plans to celebrate?
Oh, I think we'll make a special effort to be sure that it's in the newsletter, and we'll put it out on the Loaf chat line, and we will have a birthday cake.
Yeah, we'll eat cake.
Let them eat cake. And so the criteria, of course, is that you be a lesbian.
Right.
That you be 50 or older, but you don't have to be 50 to be involved with the group, because you can bring younger friends or partners that
we
are not yet 50.
We have partners who are not 50. And that's fine. We would never exclude the partner of a woman who was 50.
Mm-hmm.
We have one woman in Loaf who was partnered at about age 41 or 42 and has been, and she's currently about 52 or 3. So she's been in Loaf a long time.
Well, longer than some of the other
right.
folks.
Uh-huh.
And there is a diversity of people who are involved in that 30-year odd span of ages. But Margaret was talking about the model of getting older and being active. So, and I always say, hey, Loaf makes me tired because I read about, oh my, they're off doing this and they're off doing that. So what are some of the things that people are involved in?
Well, we've got one participant in the Senior Olympics, and some of us like to go to the casinos. Some of them like to go fishing. Just all sorts of, just you name it, somebody in the group will do it.
Very active RV group.
Yeah.
RV as in?
Recreational vehicle. Go on camping trips and...
Lesbians and camping, another weird concept.
Yeah. Well, we've got four...
Of course, that's more my style, doing it in an RV. You know, I have to have indoor plumbing.
We've got four rigs with seven of our women who have been on the road since the 1st of July, and as we speak, they're right around Tacoma, Washington. So they've been on the road now for 6 weeks or more.
I wish I was with them.
Charlotte doesn't like to stay home. She likes to be on the go.
Well, we love being out.
Y'all go out quite a bit. I mean, yeah. Both of you travel.
We
y'all travel together
mm-hmm.
and around the country mm-hmm. and network with lesbians around
all
the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this fall, I'm going to caravan with some other women, and we're going to go to New England. We'll be gone about 8 weeks in that journey.
And that'll be with an RV,
mm-hmm.
RV group.
Mm-hmm.
group. Well, so there you have it.
Comets basketball.
Oh, yeah. We can't forget that. Big part of being in Loaf is going to the Comets game and being supporters. And go Tina Thompson.
Uh-huh.
She's rocking. She's really coming into her own now, mm-hmm. I think. Let's give contact information if someone is interested in being involved in Loaf, finding out more information.
There is a contact number. It has been the same for 20 years now. 713-869-1482.
Give it again.
713-869-1482.
And thank you, Loaf, for being on Queer Voices.
If your heart always did what a normal heart should do, if you always play a part instead of being who you are, and you might just miss the one who's standing there. So instead of passing by, show him that you care. Instead of the madness that we're taught, never questioning the rules that we're living lies we bought so long ago. How are they to know? It's not who's wrong or right, it's just another way. I don't wanna fight, but no, I'm gonna stay. Yeah.
don't have is time.
That was Michael Callan from 1989, Love Don't Need a Reason. This is Queer Voices.
Hello again.
And we're back with another guest. You know, usually on Queer Music Heritage Night, we're not quite this busy, but we had some openings and some folks that were available, and we said, let's get them in here. So I invited Tom Zeflin to join us tonight, and I have to say I have used his massage services, and I highly recommend him personally. We ran into each other at House of Pies one night and got to talking. And, you know, there was just something about him I liked right away. And then I found out that he had been voted best massage therapist in Houston in Outsmart magazine. Now, was that last year, Tom?
Yes, it was. It was in September they did the voting, and the results were published in October.
So,
congratulations.
Thank you much.
That's really something.
How long have you been a massage therapist?
I graduated from Health Master School Massage in September 2001, so almost 6 years.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a specialty in your massage?
Yes, I do, ma'am.
Ma'am?
That's a Texas style.
I'm a ma'am.
I provide mainly deep tissue and sports massage. I had taken several classes after that in sports massage and sports rehabilitation classes.
Uh-huh. And so you work primarily on men, women?
I do men and women both. One thing being gay here in Houston, you know, a lot of massage therapists, the men do the men. But yes, I do promote my women clients as well.
Mm-hmm.
You can lay hands on me anytime.
Well, believe me, I have a special health condition, fibromyalgia, which means I have sore, achy muscles all the time, and I can't handle, like, too much pressure. It's just going to hurt. So Tom did a great job and helped me feel a lot better. So why should someone get a massage?
The main reason is, a lot of people come to me because they want the deep tissue sports work. A lot of my clients come to me for because of poor posture, because their upper back neck hurts, and that's what I specialize in. Also, I have clients that come for stress relief. So, yeah, those are the two main biggies.
Mm-hmm.
What areas do you work on stress relief?
For stress relief, mainly just I have an awesome massage studio. I have a 3-tier waterfall in there with tropical plants, real dark environment, and I play new age music. It's lighting is very dim, and just the environment in itself is enough to make clients relax, and the feel of my massage is also relaxing as well as therapeutic.
Do you use any kind of special creams or oils?
Yes, I do, Deborah. I use the main two products I use is Biotin Massage Gel. Biotin is a universal product that is well known in the market for massage. And I also use something called BioFreeze, which is what chiropractors use. BioFreeze is a chiropractic product. It is a professional grade product that is used to break up muscle tension, stress, and knots. And I use those in all the areas such as your upper back, your neck, your lower back, and in your glutes.
I've used BioFreeze before whenever I've injured a muscle, mm-hmm. and they've been giving it to me, yeah.
So do people come to you, like, after an injury because they're runners, because they're bodybuilders, that they need the sports massage?
Yeah, a lot of people come to me, number one, mainly because they feel fatigued and sore.
It hurts.
It hurts, exactly. They're stressed out. They're, you know, their necks are messed up. Their upper backs are messed up. And that's probably the majority of my clients. There are some that just come for relaxation mm-hmm. purposes as well.
And so how does that help them? What do you do in massage that helps them with the stress?
Mainly, like I just said before, the environments. I have a way of talking to my clients, number one, to get them relaxed. I think that's very, very important. That puts me above some of the other massage therapists. When I bring you into my studio, we sit down, we talk about your needs at once, and when you do that, a client will be relaxed in that setting, and then once you get back in the massage studio, I just make them feel comfortable, and I go at it.
Well, what are some of the conditions that stress can cause that that people could get massaged that would help them get through the stress? I mean, stress is, you know, it's a big, fast-moving world out there. There's traffic, there's work, there's, you know, all exactly. these busy, and you just sometimes you just can't stand it anymore. And so what can happen when you get all stressed out like that?
Well, a lot of the people that come to me for that are stressed out, mainly a lot of us that sit at computers. Mm-hmm. You know, we're hunched over the computers all day. Doctors and attorneys come to me because they're stressed out for the type of work that they do. I have school teachers that come to me. I'm sure the kids stress them out. You know, we have all millions of reasons why we come for stress relief.
And, you know, they say that one of the number one medical problems is stress because it can affect your health in so many ways.
Exactly.
That whatever health situation you're in, even if you're in good health, the stress can make you feel bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I know that, you know, a lot of people have had massages, but for those people who haven't had a massage, what kind of environment? I know for women, there's a concern, well, what do we take off all our clothes? Right. What do we have on? So make all us women comfortable.
Okay. For me, that's the most important thing is my women clientele. And here's what I recommend to my women clients is, first of all, let's just say this. Getting a massage, you really do want to take off all your clothes because I get into the glutes. The glutes are the center pivot point of your body, and you've got a lot of pressure points in there. Okay, the gluteus maximus, which is the outer part of the glute.
That would be the buttocks.
The buttocks,
the
right.
Buttocks.
So what I do for my women clients, number one, is I make sure if they have long hair to make sure that they put their hair up, because I do thoroughly work on the neck area. Secondly, what I do, if they want to, they can wear bikini underwear, like a thong type deal, where the gluteus maximus is
not
exposed.
Not me.
Where the gluteus maximus
I
is
like
exposed.
Thongs.
Well,
there you go. And
I'm sure
you
our listening audience
wear them all the time. I don't have any other kind.
Well,
I have a pair of boxers, but those are for special occasions.
And then also what I do, Deb, is when my women clientele, I show them my studio. I tell them to get under they all my women clients go drape, so I have them get under their sheet, and then I knock before I come back in, just courtesy, you know, and that makes a woman feel relaxed.
Yeah, and I'm sure guys need to be made comfortable too. They don't automatically just feel comfortable taking off their clothes and
exactly
someone they haven't met before.
A similar situation with them too, and with men.
Well, most men. Well, I'll call them women too. Most men are not as modest as women. Men don't care if they go nude, and in the state of Texas, you know, in a private studio, you are allowed to go nude. Now, some of my men will go draped with a towel. Some just go totally nude in my studio. That is allowed.
Yeah. I
but
know
it is all professional.
Okay. I know, going back to the women a moment, and just a question of concern, that I know that from experience, that actually, to put a woman at ease, that the breasts are left alone unless you give special permission to even touch them? Is that correct?
That is correct. There is written consent by the state of Texas that, first of all, I do not do breast massages on women because of liability, and plus two, I don't think it's good that a male does that. I really think that should be done by a female, personally. So that part is not even an option with me as far as women and giving breast massages.
But if should a woman other than
I'll
you
handle
go
the breast massages, Jennifer?
Okay. Well, I just want to make sure if someone does go to another therapist, massage therapist, they have the right to say don't do this. They've got to give permission
right.
to do it.
There is special consent that has to be
okay.
signed for that.
Just want to make sure that our listeners out there know that.
That brings to a good question. What are some important questions that clients ask you before getting a massage? And what do you think is the main thing that they need to do in working with you?
Well, most importantly, the first thing that I want to say to my clients is please just relax. You know, and I try to put them at ease, number one, when they come in the door and we talk about the confidential client history that I have them fill out. I want them to be, feel relaxed, and we talk about their needs and wants, number one. When you do that, you put the client in a comfortable situation. A lot of massage therapists will just take them back in their studio and work on them. Well, you know, I wouldn't be relaxed with that kind of environment. The kind of questions I get asked are like, are general questions is, do I tip a massage therapist? In a personal studio such as mine, there, you know, really, I don't believe that you need to tip a massage therapist since I am working for myself. Now, if you were going to a spa or, let's say, a massage school, yeah, you might want to tip the therapist because they're working on a commission or a percentage. Questions that get asked, should I, like the women clients, do I remove my underwear? I pretty much leave that an option up to them. I tell them that it's best that they do because I work the glutes, but their privacy is protected, which is most important, and I make sure I reinsure that to them. For your male clients, okay, will I get an erection? Well, you're taught in massage school, okay? When you touch the human body, yes, men can get erection. It's just a matter of ignoring it. You know, do I talk during a massage? I always state that up front to my clients. It is, if they want to talk to me, they can talk. If they want to just veg out, that they can also veg out. It's all client independent, you know, depending on what the client wants and what they want to do. One good question is, how often should I get massages? I pretty much give that personal, professional opinion to my clients afterwards.
Just to wrap up here, we need to tell folks how they can get in touch with you if they want to find out more.
There are a couple ways you can get a hold of me. You can get into my website at www.zeppelinmassage.com. That's ZEPPELINMASSAGE.com. That is my website. You can also find me on MasseurFinder.com, and you can also find me in Outsmart Magazine in the back.
Well, there you go. And Tom is in private practice as a massage therapist. He's very good, and he will work with you and talk to you about how massage can benefit you. And he also has had a bit of an interesting life I'm going to invite him to come back again and talk to us about, kind of how he came to be where he is today. Went from being a engineer.
I was an electronic engineer of 18 years.
To a massage therapist.
To a massage therapist, yes.
Voted best in Houston in Outsmart Magazine. Thanks for being with us on Queer Voices.
Well, thank you so much, Debbie. Thank you.
I'm Dean Elzinga.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 21st, 2007. Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern repeated promises this week that his coalition government would push for civil partnership legislation for same-gender couples this year. His remarks came as he officially reopened the LGBT Outhouse Community Center in central Dublin, a facility that survived two arson attacks. The refurbished outhouse has a cafe, library, and office space for 70 groups working on LGBT issues. It receives more than 25,000 visitors annually. The Prime Minister said that this government is committed to providing a more supportive and secure legal environment for same-sex couples. He noted that a special commission had recommended that lesbian and gay couples be given all the rights and responsibilities of their heterosexually married counterparts. Outhouse manager Louise Tierney called the lack of legal recognition a barrier to real equality, adding that it engenders discrimination and puts gay people at distinct disadvantage when it comes to basic rights. She said that many elderly LGBT people are particularly reluctant to utilize senior care health services because they fear discrimination. She also called for resources to set up a child care area in the outhouse for working lesbi-gay parents.
A lesbian couple currently living in Ireland may need child care. A man who donated his sperm to them won a legal fight this week to keep his biological son in the country, at least for the time being. The lesbian couple, one Irish and the other an Australian, entered into a civil partnership in January 2006, soon after they became legal in the United Kingdom. The Irish woman became pregnant by the Irish sperm donor, and they signed a contract giving him visitation rights with the boy, who was born in May 2006. But both sides' lawyers have said that tensions quickly grew. The couple soon restricted the man's access to the boy, then told him that they planned to go to Australia for up to a year and that they were considering a move there. Neither side has been identified following Ireland's policy of anonymity in family law cases. Justices Susan Denham and Joseph Finnegan ruled that the child's best interests required him to stay in Ireland near his biological father, limiting the couple's Australian trip with their son to a maximum of 6 weeks. The third judge, Justice Niall Fennelly, disagreed. He said that no evidence was offered that the toddler would be harmed by leaving Ireland. The case is utterly unique and unprecedented, Fennelly wrote in his dissent, noting that neither the parental rights of sperm donors nor lesbian couples are defined in Irish law. The biological father filed two lawsuits, one to limit the duration of the trip and another seeking joint custody. The Supreme Court majority limited the couple's travels outside Ireland with the boy until the custody claim is argued, which is expected later this year.
In the U.S., a county circuit court judge decided this week that Oregon state laws granting parental rights to heterosexuals unconstitutionally discriminate against families headed by same-gender couples. Multnomah County Judge Eric Block cited a landmark 1998 Oregon anti-discrimination law to rule that offering benefits based on marriage while not permitting same-gender couples access to the same benefits constitutes illegal discrimination. He also found that the Oregon Family Fairness Act, also called the Domestic Partnership Law, would resolve the problem provided it goes into effect as scheduled on January 1st. However, a signature collection effort currently underway by the right-wing Constitution Party is intended to delay the law's implementation and put it to a public vote on the November 2008 ballot.
Meanwhile, almost 3 out of 4 Hebrew-speaking Jews living in Israel would accept a gay or lesbian child. Of those polled in a recent Ynet Gesher poll, 43% said they'd feel bad about the situation but accept the child and his or her partner anyway, while 30% would have no problem with it. 15% of the respondents would be very angry with the child and would maintain only minimal contact, and the final 12% would end contact completely. Women polled more lesbi-gay-friendly than men, 79% to 66%. Not unexpectedly, ultra-Orthodox Haredi Jews were the most homophobic. 55% said they'd fully cut off their child. Pollsters also asked a question about problematic neighbors. 12% would not want to live next to a same-gender couple. 13% don't want Christian neighbors. 18% would prefer not to live next to a Haredi family. And 38% don't want a noisy musical family living next door.
In other news this week, Hong Kong's highest court has overturned a ban on gay sodomy in what are considered to be public places. The case stemmed from the prosecution of two men who acknowledged engaging in sodomy in a parked car on an isolated road at night. The men challenged their arrests, and lower courts ruled in their favor, but the government appealed to Hong Kong's Court of Final Appeal. The case was the first prosecution of a 1991 law criminalizing gay sex in any other than a private place, and carried a maximum prison term of 5 years. A panel of 5 top judges unanimously dismissed the government's appeal this week. Chief Justice Andrew Lee said in the ruling that the law targets only gay men and does not criminalize heterosexuals for the same or comparable conduct, and is therefore discriminatory. Last year, a 20-year-old Hong Kong gay man successfully challenged the Chinese territory's unequal age of consent law, which punished men under 21 who engaged in sodomy with up to life in prison. The consensual age for heterosexual intercourse in Hong Kong is 16. A local judge ruled in 2005 that the law infringed on the rights of gay men. The Hong Kong government also unsuccessfully appealed that ruling. The court rulings overturning these laws haven't automatically removed them from the books, however. Hong Kong legislators are still required to formally repeal them, although they're now virtually unenforceable. Some observers believe the government will drag its feet on official repeal to avoid an outcry from conservative religious groups and other traditionalists.
A defamation and libel conviction against Austria's leading lesbi-gay organization, Homosexual Initiative Vienna, and its Secretary General, Kurt Krickler, has been overturned by the Vienna Regional Criminal Court. Austrian People's Party Member of Parliament Walter Tansitz filed the lawsuit after Krickler called him a mental descendant of the brown Nazi minions in a press release condemning the lawmaker for spearheading the exclusion of gays and lesbians from the Nazi Victim Compensation Act. A lower court convicted Krickler in April 2006, sentencing him to 3 years probation and the choice of a fine of 240 euros, about 329 U.S. dollars, or a month in jail. Under the terms of the conviction, Krickler wouldn't have had to pay the fine or serve time if he didn't commit another crime during the probationary period. But the appeals court decided Krickler's denunciation of Tansitz was simply the expression of an opinion, which is permissible, rather than stating as fact something that is untrue, which can be libelous. Krickler called the acquittal a great victory for freedom of speech and human rights in Austria, and noted that Tansitz now has to pay all legal costs of both parties.
Hundreds of LGBT people marched on July 7th in the 6th annual Pride Parade in Lima, Peru. They demanded passage of the proposed Law of Equal Opportunities Between Men and Women and urged that the measure specifically include protections for lesbians. Organizers also condemned anti-queer violence, claiming that there were at least 600 homophobic attacks in Peru last year and that many of them were committed by police officers.
Gay Pride in the Maltese capital of Valletta attracted only about 50 people on July 6th, fewer than at the first march 4 years ago. Marchers included British member of the European Parliament David Bowles, Education Minister Luis Galea, Labour MP Everest Bartolo, and Alternativa Democratica Party Chairman Harry Vassallo. Malta Gay Rights Movement Coordinator Gabriela Calleja told the Times of Malta newspaper that LGBT people there are afraid to come out publicly. At the recent Pride Party, there were about 1,000 people or more, she said. But here, given the cameras and journalists and in broad daylight, it's a different story.
And finally, every 4 years, the South Pacific Games hosts athletes from 22 countries in multi-sport competition. The 13th Quadrennial Games kick off on August 25th this year in the Samoan capital of Apia, with over 5,000 athletes and spectators expected. But it won't be without a bit of controversy. Team Samoa issued a memo in early July to its athletes and officials warning them not to have gay or lesbian sex during the games. The Samoa Observer newspaper published the full text of the memo banning homosexual activity, which said in part, "Do not embarrass yourself, your family, and your country by trying this in the village." It went on to say, "Best not to even think about this. It's against the law of God." Outrage ensued, prompting South Pacific Games Organizing Committee Chairman Tapasu Leong-Wai to quickly contact the press to say that the policy was simply part of a draft of the rules and that it hadn't been officially approved by the committee. Homosexual indecency in Samoa, however, is punishable by up to 5 years in prison. But, said Wai, "We do not have any hard feelings about anybody, whatever you do. We respect whatever status you have. Let the games begin."
And that's News Wrap for the week ending July 21st, 2007. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Dean Elzinga.
And I'm Greg Gordon. That other Clinton woman speaks her mind. But first, we'll take a minute to review the private life of an earlier political grand dame.
Eleanor Roosevelt's love letters, coming up on the Rainbow Minute. Eleanor Roosevelt, the controversial first lady of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was a crusader for women's rights, civil rights for African Americans, world peace, and the plight of the poor. As U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, she often addressed issues of international human rights. In many ways, Eleanor led a life apart from her husband. She met Associated Press sports reporter Lorena Hickok shortly before 1932 and wore a sapphire ring given to her while still living in the White House. Wanting to be closer to Eleanor, Lorena left her reporting job and worked in the Roosevelt administration. They often found time together and, when apart, exchanged thousands of letters over a period of 30 years. Many of the letters from Lorena to Eleanor were destroyed, but Lorena made arrangements for the letter she'd received from Eleanor to be published upon her death. In one letter, Eleanor wrote, quote, "I want to put my arms around you. I ache to hold you close." The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios of WRIR in Richmond, Virginia. My name is Dustin Richardson.
You're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine, brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, reviews of LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org. You can also demonstrate your solidarity by taking part in an online benefit auction. Look for the This Way Out area at alternabid.com. Again, to find out more about special CD thank you gifts, subscriptions, and the auction, please do log on to thiswayout.org, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA.
Once when my dad was visiting, we invited friends over for dinner, and the only conversation rule I laid down ahead of time was no discussion of sex. That was for my benefit. My father sat and listened through dinner conversations of gay politics, gay theory, gay gossip, and toward the end of the discussion, I turned to my dad and asked, "Well, Mr. Clinton, we have a very formal relationship. What do you think we as gay people can do to make more bridges to straight people?" My dad did one of his patented, exquisitely timed pauses and replied, "Keep talking."
I love to laugh loud and long and clear. I love to laugh. It's getting worse every year. The more I laugh, the more I fill with glee, and the more the glee, the more I'm a merrier me. It's embarrassing, the more I'm a merrier me.
The irrepressible Kate Clinton is a self-avowed, faith-based, tax-paying, America-loving, political humorist, and family entertainer. For 25 years, her goal has been to raise consciousness through comedy, and she's done it during some of the most depressing, bizarre, frightening, confounding times in history, and 10 U.S. presidential inaugurations. In addition to her live performances, Clinton has appeared on stage and screen, narrated documentaries, written for newspapers, magazines, and television, and emceed numerous benefits. She's been a panelist on mainstream news programs and hosted U.S. Public Television's LGBT show In the Life. The audio version of her first book, Don't Get Me Started, was named one of 1998's best audiobooks by Publishers Weekly, and her second book, What the L, was nominated for a 2005 Lambda Literary Award. Now Kate Clinton is on the road again, taking on the truly good, the ethically bad, and the politically ugly. During a recent conversation with This Way Out's Josie Catoccio, Clinton shared her thoughts on Sister Hillary, the power of political humor, and Vice President Dick Cheney's lesbian daughter, Mary.
Speaking of Cheney, who, by the way, I love it when you called him the Bush Whisperer. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite lines of yours. What do you think about his daughters finally delivering the babies, which used to, by the way, called the Gavy Boom instead of the Baby Boom? All of us lesbians having babies.
Well, you know, I was amazed at my friends who were so excited that Mary was pregnant. I just didn't quite know why.
The virgin birth.
I guess. And, it certainly sort of muddies the issues. And, you know, as every time anybody who is gay comes out, you know, suddenly people who have been talking about lofty issues of homophobia and homosexuality and the immorality, when you finally have an actual person, it really kind of, it's very inconvenient. So, I mean, I think you can talk all you want, but here's an actual lesbian with an actual child and...
But no personality.
Well...
I mean, when she was on tour for her book, I mean, I was amazed that she didn't seem to have any personality.
I think she's probably at the very... Can you imagine? I mean, what do they talk about around the house? And they just totally ignore it altogether? You know, I think there's probably in many, 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 many myriad ways she's had to tamp down whatever personality she has from the union of the Bush Whisperer and his lovely wife, Lon Chaney.
You know. Lon Chaney.
I don't know. I mean, I just think it's amazing hypocrisy, but if she's able to live with herself, so be it.
Well, I just thought it was remarkable that when she was on book tour, she was on some talk show, I can't remember which one, but she was talking about how, well, I was able to campaign for my father because I thought national security was the most important issue, and, you know, I couldn't talk about anything else because that was more important than anything.
Yeah, well, sell yourself to the devil, dear.
I guess.
Yeah. She's made some deal. I think that level of being able to, you know, compartmentalize as she must have to do, I guess, you know, I think a lot of times anybody's like Cheney or Bush, any good qualities they have are just pure projection on my part. I don't know if they actually have them.
Well, you're a multimedia phenomenon. You've done two books, What the L and Don't Get Me Started.
Mm-hmm.
You've done DVDs. Talk a little bit about what you've got coming up.
Well, I have a new tour that I'm on. It's called the Climate Change Tour. And certainly that, you know, I believe that the political climate is changing. And I also think that absolutely the climate is changing. So I'm talking about that. And I'll be working in Provincetown in July and August. And, you know, I'm working on a new collection of essays. It's about time, I think, to put one together. So I've got a lot going on.
Let's talk a little bit about your sister, Hillary. You used to joke during the Clinton years that Bill was your brother, and now that Hillary's on the campaign trail, you've actually got a lot more material, don't you?
I know. It never stopped. There's this kind of amazing kind of double helix right now. It was like Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton. It's like it keeps going on and on. And, you know, I don't... You know, I'm very, very excited. I'm happy that Hillary's is in it, and we can get to talk about the levels of sexism in the country. And, you know, I just think it's great that she's running. And, I mean, time and time again, you hear about people who are prepared not to like her who say she's really hardworking and she's really smart. And, you know, I mean, I just have great confidence in her ability to work. I've certainly been disappointed in, you know, one of the latest things was when, you know, Peter Pace said that homosexuals are too immoral to fight in an immoral war. It's fabulous. I'm kind of proud of that.
Well, they always want to keep us in the service when we're at war. It's like don't ask, don't tell, unless we're at war, in which case we're not going to say anything because we want to keep you in there and let you die, you know?
Really, and you guys get in the front. You're great. We were kidding. You're great soldiers. Get up in the front. No, don't stay in the green zone. You hate that color. You know, get out. But, you know, I think it took her just 3 days too long to actually have a really clear statement. And, you know, I think Democrats are in big trouble if once again they will not absolutely be clear. You can say, you know, I'm not comfortable around homosexuals, but it's the right thing to do. I mean, how hard is that?
Yeah.
To paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, and I'm as terrified as anything that I'm doing it, but it's sort of like, at this point, we're going to go to the polls with the one we have, not the one we wish we had. And it might be Hillary. It's been very quiet from the Obama corner lately. I'm concerned that he doesn't have a lot of people red in the ground. That really, you know, you just need those people that he, I don't know if he's too late to get them in place, but, you know, I'm kind of proud that, you know, the Democrats have they're running a woman, that they have a black man, that, you know, that we have, you know, that there's a lot of choices. I think the early campaigning is just a signal of just how quickly we want to get rid of George. Well, see, I think campaigns should only be 6 weeks long. And then if you talk about it a campaign before or after, then you will be killed.
Whoa.
They're talking about $10 billion that's going to be spent on this election. With that money, we could right now just forgive all student loans.
Really?
And,
really?
It's, you know, and during that 6 weeks, the only thing on television, and television is free for, and the only thing on television is politics. It's campaigns, it's debates, it's conversations, it's all of that. And the only way you can get that off your television is by voting.
Wow.
Is that brilliant?
What a radical idea.
Thank you. No one talks to me about these ideas, but because, it, you know, I've always felt that, you know, if we had the technology that I could, like, vote to get, you know, vote somebody off the island or not to be American Idol, I could certainly choose my president. Please. They could figure, I mean, I'm sure they know how to do it now, but they just don't want that many people voting.
Speaking about technology, let's talk a little bit about your DVDs.
Ah.
Because I'm from the old days of LPs. I remember your brightly colored LPs of comedy.
I had a blue LP and a red LP.
I remember.
Oh, my God. One time I met this wonderful, I think it was the first punk rocker I ever met. She was fierce looking. She had this, like, you know, 8 foot tall mohawk and, like, rings hanging off everywhere. And she goes, I really like your red album. I said, oh, thank you. And she said, it really melted down to make a great ashtray. But I do have a DVD from a show that was recorded by Here Television, and then in hopefully after the summer I'll have another DVD out of a show that I did in Long Beach, which was the kickoff of my 25th anniversary tour. It's called It's Come to This, and the DVD has lots of extras and lots of. We had people who I asked people if they would just like give me quick video happy anniversaries, and you know, like Lily Tomlin did a rap song.
Wow.
And Melissa Etheridge and Cynthia Nixon and Billie Jean King. So all of that's on there. It's really, really very sweet.
Your 25th anniversary in comedy.
I know. That's a lot of comedy.
Oh, my goodness.
And I will be turning 60 this year.
Are you serious?
Yes.
My goodness, and you look so young.
Thank you.
How's that
much.
For an ageist thing to say? You hot
well,
thing, you. And speaking of anniversaries, you've been with Irva Shivad, who is one of the most amazing political minds of any generation, in my opinion, for quite a while. And you've jokingly called yourself the marriage of comedy and tragedy. She used to be head of the National Lesbian and Gay Task Force.
Yep, she is quite the little visionary, and she wakes up like that. We've been together almost 20 years. It'll be 20 years next year.
Wow, mazel tov.
Thank you. And she really, you know, I think that it really has been a great combination. I think that certainly she's given me lots more content. She always says to me after a show, she says, well, that was too long. And you need to do more politics.
That's like, true.
Okay.
But you got to do comedy, and sometimes, you know, one of the things I love about your work is that you get politics across with a punch because you're doing it as comedy.
Exactly. I think that, you know, I think that comedy is well able to carry the weight of serious. I think that going the other way, it's often kind of jarring, serious, and somebody suddenly funny, and you're like, what? But I do think that people are open when they're laughing and that they're able to hear things they might not ordinarily hear. I mean, I have people who leave my show and say, well, I'm a Republican, but I laughed.
Yeah.
I think that's good.
We love to laugh. Loud and long and clear. We love to laugh. So everybody can hear.
That was Josie Cattogio laughing with lesbian feminist humorist Kate Clinton. You can keep up with Kate at kateclinton.com.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hello,
that's not a hotline. Let me reassure you. You are all woman. That's right. You, sitting there, crossing your legs in that certain fashion, trying to keep your brow from going down when you get angry, and adjusting that wig cap in just the right way so when you sit at Starbucks, you make sure that nothing's hanging out. Thanks for calling Transgendered Hotline, and have a great transgender day.
One, two, one, two, three. Johnny and Betty went to high school together, and Johnny and Betty went steady. Because Johnny and Betty knew that someday they'd be ready to say, forget what we've learned, we're gay. Johnny and Betty went to high school together, and Johnny and Betty went steady. Because Johnny and Betty knew that someday, not today, they'd be ready to say, forget all the lessons we've learned, we're gay. When the rings are going on to the fingers everywhere, everybody asking these two if they're gonna tie the knot, they nod shyly and say, well, maybe, and they smile wisely and say, well, maybe not. Betty learned to sew her own dress, and Johnny was a champion at chess. Ordinary kids, you know, just plain folk, who keep the love stuff to yourself and laugh at all of their jokes. Swimming with the tide until the tide goes out. Swimming with the tide until. Swimming with the tide until the tide goes out. Swimming with the tide until. Well, we know the world's not perfect and the world's not strong, so we know someone will suffer by the end of the song. Someone will get bashed before the end of the verse. The only question is, who got bashed first? And it was Johnny, discovered in what they call Boys Town. A high school buddies out of nowhere grab him and spin him around, and then they hit him in the face and laugh and kick him to the ground. Johnny, with a swollen face and Betty's puffed from crying, agree there's no going back, being attacked is like dying, and dying is like leaving. So they ran, they didn't take much, they took what they could carry, talked about the future and decided they should marry. They should live their separate lives, but keep it quiet, keep it calm, keep the love to themselves, and keep themselves away from harm. Swimming with the tide until the tide goes out. Swimming with the tide until. Swimming with the tide until the tide goes out. Swimming with the tide until. And what a lovely day on the beach it will be for our heroes, Betty and Johnny, and all of their friends as the crowd swooshes out to sea, leaving all of the different ones shining and free.
Welcome to Queer Voices on KPFT. And this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and this month I'm bringing you part 3 of my latest series on the music of transgendered artists. And it will include some special interviews. Starting the show was a fun cell phone ringtone, courtesy of the folks of Medialicious.tv. They've got lots of fun podcasts to amuse you and a bunch of special ringtones. That one was done by Alexandra Billings, who was my feature interview for last month's show. After the ringtone was Canadian artist Maren Cadell. The song Johnny and Betty came from her 1993 album Bombazine. While the subject matter of that song was gay, Maren is featured on this show because, as of 2003, she became a he. Maren retired from the music business following the last CD, released in 1997. I want to add that Maren had a Canadian Top 40 hit in 1991 with a song called The Sweater. I encourage you to visit YouTube.com to check out the quirky video for that song. Oh, but please wait until after this show, as I wouldn't want you to miss my two special interviews with the duo Coyote Grace and Joshua Clip. But first, my regular listeners know how I love to dig into our history and share musical obscurities. And this one is surely obscure. In 1978, a kind of dance-oriented album was released in Los Angeles titled The Jupiter Ray Band with Lily Rose. Lily Rose was the stage name for Lillian Tabor, though that was not her original name, but the one she took after her transition. Information is sketchy on her, but I understand she lived in the Denver area and was in several other bands, and for a time was a member of the Angels of Light, an offshoot of the Coquettes. One of my website visitors who knew her has told me that her looks were stunning, and she was also an amazing makeup artist, costume designer, and hairstylist. Sadly, she died in 2000 at age 48. From the Jupiter Ray Band from 1978 is the song Dance With Me.
With me, darling, won't you dance with me?
come to the first interview of the show with Coyote Grace. This is a duo made up of Coyote Joe Stevens and Ingrid Ion, whose nickname is Grace. Partners on and off stage, they are respectively from California and Ohio, but now work out of the Seattle area. According to the verbiage on their website, their love of music and for each other permeates every song, conveyed through smooth harmonies, driving roots rhythms, and captivating lyrics of raw life experience. They released their debut album called Boxes and Bags a few months ago, and I'm very pleased with it, as I immediately fell in love with Joe's voice. And you'll see why right now.
Now I took her to the road the other day. My city walls, they crumble, fade away. Paid my respects by the water side. It's where my God and my people reside. The sun it shines now all across the land, from the California waters to the shores of Maryland. The sun it shines now all across this world, but right now it is shining on the girl. And it's so bright.
The first question I asked Coyote Joe was to tell me about the new album.
It's called Boxes and Bags, and it was our first debut studio album. We recorded it in Seattle last year. It's all original material by Joe Stevens. It sounds a lot like us live. It's very indie folk, alt folk, we call it. The title came about basically because we travel a lot and everything we own fits into either a box or a bag. So that's kind of how we live, and it's very telling of our troubadour lifestyle. We hope you like it.
Tell me about the name Coyote Grace.
Coyote Grace actually came about, it was a fusion of our two old stage names, hers being Amazing Grace and mine being Coyote Joe.
On your website, you are open about being a trans man. Was being this open a difficult decision for you?
We definitely did talk about it a lot. You know, on the one hand, I want to be seen as a musician. On the other hand, I want to have visibility for trans people, because that's something that's new. And I figured if we just kind of got it out there in the open, then we wouldn't have to be throwing it in anybody's face or anything. Like, we're just trying to be honest and be out.
Tell me about the song, A Guy Named Joe.
I wrote that a little less than a year ago. It's kind of a mourning song in a way. I was really in the thick of my transition, and it was kind of about the strange feeling of going through this whole huge emotional process, and then kind of on the other end of it, you're just a normal guy, and you have to relearn how to integrate into the world. So it was kind of a mourning period for me.
Take me down a notch, a peg or a level or two. The swollen moon has got a sight set on me too. The devil's son gonna take me higher, higher than I ever been before. I told my mama, no, I can't take no more, I can't take no more. Take me down to the empty farm where I grew up on the land. Built this childhood and foreign boy with my own two hands. I look around them bony trees and sunken cows. There's almost snow. Nobody knows nothing except what me and the crow do know. Life, who am I to weather a storm? But I go slow.
guy named Joe.
How old were you when you figured out that you wanted to be a man?
Well, I knew when I was four, but it took me till I graduated college to really see that I needed to do this in order to carry on with my life. So it was definitely always there, but it took me a little while to figure out that I really needed to follow through with transition.
Did the transition process change your voice?
It did. It dropped it about an octave, and I had written quite a few songs before then and had to kind of change them around quite a bit. It changed my style a little bit, but not very much. I was always writing songs that were too low for me before. It's kind of telling, but yeah, there's a couple songs on the album that I wrote as a soprano. Now I'm a baritone. But I had to stop singing for a good 8 months, which was kind of rough.
Have you found that there are some people who can't get past the novelty to them that you're a trans man when they should be focused on your talent?
Sometimes. We play for a lot of GLBT folks now anyway, and they're pretty cool about it. But yeah, sometimes after a show, all they want to know about is what parts I have, which is kind of annoying. But by far, most people forget, which I think is interesting, because I look so male to them, I think.
And I don't mean to neglect Ingrid, the Grace part of the duo. What challenges have you had performing with this act?
Well, I think mainly I performed with a couple of different ensembles since I started playing upright bass, and Joe and I had got together and played very casually before he transitioned, and we were a couple then. And then it wasn't until he kind of got through the first year or so of transition, got his voice settled, was kind of ready to start making moves to being in a band, that he was really ready to kind of invest musically. So during that, I was playing with another band, a bluegrass band called Captain Gravel out of Seattle with four other guys. And so when time came, when, you know, Coyote Grace started becoming more of the priority in my life and we were getting ready to travel and leave Seattle, it was challenging for me to leave that other band and to leave behind the music scene that I had kind of become involved in. So that's been hard. And another thing is I do the most of the booking and the promotional work for Coyote Grace. So, you know, it's hard to, you know, how much to put it out there in our promotional material that we're queer or that he's a trans singer-songwriter. And you know, we kind of just play it by ear, and you know, the ones who are obviously more GLBTQ oriented, we, you know, kind of make sure that they know that that's why we're applying. You know, otherwise we just leave it for people to either read between the lines or, you know, absorb what they absorb. But basically we're just out there being ourselves and playing our music, and if people pick up on it, great, and if they don't, whatever, they'll take away something from it.
Is there a song on the album that particularly tells your story?
I think Ghost Boy, that's also a little bit of a grieving song, but just kind of how I feel now, having lived this other life that is somewhat invisible to a lot of people. I love my life and I love who I am, but there's that recognition of what passed in a good way.
Feel the moment come, let it pass along. I remember the first one of their first day. There was someone here. When I came, she disappeared. I catch a glimpse in what people say. I am a self-made man, born with my two hands. I've been waiting for so long to finally stand. Well, I have no history. One day I just came to be. Well, I better know who I am. Well, I walk down these halls. Nobody knows my name, and I know this place.
that kid was mine too. She's everywhere. I turn a shade of blue and I didn't come back here to say I'm just a ghost boy walking through.
Again, the CD Boxes and Bags is a wonderful album. You can find out more about Coyote Grace at www.coyotegrace.com.
This is Jennifer Renee Poole, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage.
That was done by my friend and Queer Voices co-host, Jennifer Renee Poole. By the way, she's the first transgendered president of a GLBT political caucus in the country, and we're real proud of her. I mentioned that Jennifer is one of my co-hosts on Queer Voices. On that show recently, we interviewed another talented transgendered artist from San Francisco, Julia Serrano. She seems to be a renaissance woman, as she's a writer, spoken word performance artist, activist, and in her day job, a biologist. She's just published a new book called Whipping Girl, a transsexual woman on sexism and the scapegoating of femininity. I first discovered her because in the late 90s, she was in a pop trio called Bite Size, and they released two albums. I love that while this was still pre-transition, she was talking about it in the lyrics of the songs. An example of this comes from their first album from 1999, which was titled, with tongue-in-cheek, The Best of Bite Size. Here's Switch Hitter. Yes, she'll have her sex change operation, her mind's made up. According to her website, that song was actually inspired by her memories from when she was 15, watching her Little League All-Star game, when she made the decision. Of course, it took many years for the transition to happen. And being the writer that she is, she's captured a lot of that journey by publishing essays and books of her spoken word pieces. One of these books is perfect for me to share with you, as with it she included a CD. I particularly like the interesting psychology revealed in the title track from that book, Either Or.
It should have been no big deal, really. Just another Saturday night in some bar, some guy flirting with some girl, and she wasn't even interested in him, and it should have been no big deal. Except that I was the girl, and the guy was the first straight boy who ever took an interest in me. In the past, other men had hit on me, but only the ones who liked their girls to be boy underneath. But months of hormone replacement therapy had erased away most traces of my maleness, so much so that this straight boy didn't think twice before flirting with me. And it took me by surprise. We had talked for a while before he gently touched the side of my arm and smiled. And my brain went wild, with a million thoughts set off like fireworks, like my life flashing before my eyes. Years of potions and spells, cross-dressing rituals designed to conjure up the girl in me, just so I could catch a glimpse of her reflection in a bathroom mirror or a storefront window. And I wasn't even into this boy, but he made me blush. His flirts felt like hard-won accomplishments. Years of suffering and sacrifice all paid off, all because some random guy saw a real girl when he looked into my eyes. Our language doesn't have the words to describe it. This is the sort of thing that ordinarily gets taken for granted. From the time the doctor announces it's a girl or it's a boy, most people's gender is written in granite. But my gender is more like a carrot on a stick. It's always dangling right in front of me. Because I may pass as a woman, but I have a male past that runs 30-some years deep. And it's full of memories that I don't regret, secrets that I shouldn't have to keep. And every time I meet a stranger who turns into a friend, I know it's only a matter of time before I find myself telling them. And I've seen that look hundreds of times when what I am changes in someone else's eyes. And they usually act nonchalant and polite, but from that point on, I know they can't help but see the boy in me. And I'm no longer quite the girl that I used to be. My gender is like a boulder that I roll up a hill each day, only to have it come crashing back down on me. And that's why it's so tempting for me to just lose myself in those rare moments of absolute authenticity, like when that straight boy flirted with me. Because a part of me wants so desperately to be 100% female. Yet somehow, the burden of a million sins of omission seems like too high a price to pay for the privilege of simply blending in. And I know what the real problem is. Gender is exclusive. It's always either or. And I guess that makes my gender none of the above. Because my gender is the answer to a trick question. It's like that optical illusion where you either see a vase or two faces, but you can't see them both at once. My gender is more than the sum of my anatomical parts, and you can insist on seeing me as either female or male. That's up to you to decide. And if you still don't get what I'm trying to say, well, that's okay. Because my gender takes more than 3 minutes to describe.
Again, that was Julia Serrano from her spoken word CD, Either Or. Her website is an education and a fascinating visit. That's at www.juliaserrano.com.
This is Josh Clipp, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage with J.D. Doyle.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at the photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Up next is the main interview for this month by another new artist, Joshua Clipp, and I'm very pleased with this one. I found his answers interesting, articulate, and done with style and humor. Someone I'd like to know. So far, he's released an EP last year called Patience, and his full-length debut album, Won't Stop Now, came out this spring. Before we start the interview, here's just a bit of one of his songs called Time We Don't Have to Waste.
Baby girl, how you been? At the spot with your friends. Same old thing you told me then. You didn't have to lie again. What they say is true. The mirror can be very cruel. Everything you've done to me, you know what they did it to, girl. And it's sad all the time that we waste, making others believe we're okay. Just
thanks.
Joshua, tell me about the new CD.
This new album is called Won't Stop Now, and it's called that because I literally had to risk everything to get here, and now that I am, I'm only getting started. And about 3 years ago, I started gender transition, knowing that it might result in never being able to sing again, but I had to take that risk because it was really my only shot at finding peace. And here I am 3 years later, and I've released my first complete post-transition album. And the music on the album crosses genres and boundaries just like I live my life, but throughout it there's a message of hopefulness and taking risks to find your own peace. And every time someone says to me, Josh, your music has changed my life, I know I've done my job in this world as an artist, and it's a privilege to move people with my music.
Your EP was called Patience, and your album is Won't Stop Now. What's the significance of those titles?
Yeah, the EP was called Patience because that's what it took for me to get to that place where I could even start recording again. When I was contemplating gender transition, I learned that one of the things that would happen naturally was that my voice was going to drop. And I did a lot of research on what that would mean and for me vocally as a singer. And there wasn't anything out there. There was no information on how it would turn out on the other side. And ultimately, I had to make a very heart-wrenching decision to transition, knowing that it could mean I wouldn't ever be able to sing again. But I had to let that go. I had to literally let go of my ability to sing to find my own peace in my life, to be willing to know that that might not be there when I got through all of this. And of course, not being one to just want to let things go completely, I took voice lessons and I visited with a voice specialist at Stanford who actually followed me through the process and is going to publish the first article on something like this. And after a year and a half, I finally got back into the studio, and it seemed to me that the only thing I could call my first EP was Patience, because that's what it took with myself and with my voice just going through that process, a very painful, slow letting go process of the voice that I used to have.
And the title of the new one?
The title of the new one is Won't Stop Now, because now that I'm here, it's on. I'm going for it. You know, I've always loved to sing. Singing has always been my expression, but I couldn't really get behind it pre-transition because it didn't feel like it really expressed me as a human being. It was a good way to express emotion, but it wasn't true to who I was.
Did it feel like your voice didn't match yourself?
Exactly. There was always these moments. There was always that moment at the beginning of a gig. We'd be setting up, be sound checking, you know, my musicians would be setting up if I was working with a live band, and people would be kind of gathering around if it was at a bar, you know, getting their drinks or whatever in their conversations, and there's only that moment when I opened my mouth to sing the first song, everybody in the place would turn around and look at me like, where was that voice coming from? Because it was so completely different from, you know, my physical presentation. It's very masculine. My voice was very feminine. And so it didn't match up at all. And like I was saying before, I couldn't get behind it. I couldn't get behind myself as an artist completely. And now, even though I still work hard on my voice, I'm still working hard, my voice is still getting better, getting stronger, getting more flexible. I'm just so thrilled about being able to sing at all. And being able to put myself out there in the world as a vocalist.
I guess this would be a great time to ask about the significance of the song Little Girl.
Little Girl, the historical significance of it is that it's the first time that a trans man, that would be me, has recorded a song using both pre- and post-transition vocals. And the way that happened, I've had the privilege of working with the same co-writer and producer for about 6-7 years now, Christopher Cloud. And we used to write and record music back in the day, and we had recorded Little Girl years ago. Then later I went through gender transition, and afterwards when we were thinking about new music, I said, well, you know, maybe we should look at some of those old tracks. Maybe there's something I can, you know, make out of that and do like a, almost like a duet with myself. And we pulled out the Little Girl track, and I listened to it, and I got rid of the verses. I rewrote the verses. We kept the hook, and the result is what's on my album. And the verses I rewrote, they're really, it's a really personal song on a lot of levels. I mean, the verses I wrote really about my own experience and the experience of other trans people around transitioning, of sort of hitting that rock bottom place where, you know, I've got to make a change, I've got to do something here. And then moving through self-affirmation, you know, finding, looking in the mirror, and even especially I think for trans women have such a hard time when they look in the mirror and what they see doesn't match how they feel, and what they put out into the, you know, the ways that they are perceived in the world doesn't match how they feel, and trans men I think feel that a lot too. But finding self-affirmation regardless, which the way that I reflect that in the lyrics is, there's no mirror that reflects your worth. So no matter what you see in the mirror, it doesn't stand for what your worth as a human being. And then finally, the song just ends on a very hopeful, positive note of closing your eyes and dreaming of this new world, whatever that is for you. What's interesting is that in writing the song and recording it and playing it for friends and loved ones, the first thing that they would say to me is, this it doesn't even matter if this is about transition or not. This is just about a human experience of going through something really difficult. But in the process of recording it, it was a very cathartic process for me, because it sort of culminated that letting go that I referred to earlier, you know, singing alongside that voice that used to be mine and letting that go, you know, just sort of literally telling that old voice, you know, don't worry, it's going to be okay, in a way that I wish I could have told myself when I didn't know what was going to happen.
All of the lies, it wasn't worth the fight. Close to dying, you didn't know how to stop trying. You held on, almost drowned alive in the tears you cried. You broke down to a place alone.
How would you compare performing and creating your music before and after your transition?
I would say that now everything just seems to fit better. Everything just seems to feel more comfortable. I would write a song pre-transition and sing it or perform it, and it just felt too, well, it felt too girly. And it didn't feel right. And now it just makes a lot more sense. It fits. You know what I'm saying? It fits where I'm coming from, and the voice fits, and it feels a lot more cohesive, integrated.
I've read that you came out of the closet twice. First as a lesbian.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I think a lot of people, probably even trans people, have that experience. It's sort of it's certainly, I think, easier in a physical sense anyway to come out as gay than it is to come out as trans. And that was just my way of trying to cope, trying to make sense of my feelings and what I needed out of my life. And it, you know, it worked for a while, but ultimately that wasn't the perfect fit. And so that's when transitioning happened and coming out as trans.
What has been your experience regarding obtaining male privilege?
It exists. It exists. My experience of it, it's, I'll tell you, JD, it is mind-blowing. Guys don't even know it exists. And women, never having experienced it, don't even know what they're missing out on. It's just a way that the things that people assume about you, they listen to you more, people smile at you more, people take you more seriously. You know, there's just a certain level of respect that you're given. I can't even necessarily put my finger on it, but it's astounding. And it exists, and it's kind of mind-blowing.
Trans men are probably the only people who can realize this.
Yeah, I think that that's probably true. And, you know, in addition to male privilege, I think, you know, speaking to our community, the gay and lesbian community, a lot of us also get heterosexual privilege. I know that, you know, my girlfriend and I experienced that all the time. When we were seeing each other pre-transition, the ways that people treated us, you know, nobody was outright homophobic or outright disrespectful, but there are a lot of subtle differences between the ways people treated us then and the ways that they treat us now, perceiving us as a heterosexual couple.
Wow, heterosexual privilege. I've not heard it said that way.
Without a doubt. And the example that she gives, if you were to ask her, is especially, you know, when we're traveling, you know, we'll stop at a B&B or, breakfast place or something, and people just engage you more in conversation, and they smile at you more. Aren't you cute? And what are you two doing this weekend? And that sort of thing. You know, and nobody would be, if we were in that same position, you know, 4 years ago, before I transitioned, it isn't that people would, you know, look at us with disgust and treat us in openly discriminatory ways, but they wouldn't engage you as much. You know, they wouldn't be as sort of affirming of your relationship by engaging you.
Do you know a lot of other trans men?
As I go along, I seem to pick up trans guy friends, which is, you know, I don't actively seek out trans men as friends, but we sort of gravitate towards each other, I find, because we are really the only people who can sort of truly understand each other's experiences. And so when I hang out with my trans guy friends, it's like a small vacation, because I feel like I can say anything about any experience and they'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
I'm curious then about your observations, and I'm going to deliberately use the term sexual attraction instead of sexual orientation. Could you make any comments about the sexual attraction of trans men? And what I mean is, from your observations, do you think more are attracted to men or women?
That's a really interesting question, and you're probably the first person that's ever asked me that. I think that probably the majority of trans men before they transition start out as lesbians. I think. I'm generalizing a little bit here. And as trans guys go through transition, my observation is that a lot of guys, you know, they feel freer to check out being with men or being with women or whatever. And I think that, you know, I don't know that I can exactly put my finger on that. I think part of it is just hormonal. They have all this testosterone, they need to work it out. And let's face it, you know, there's at least here in the Bay Area, plenty of men to work it out with. but I think part of it is also sort of an emotional thing, because as trans men are recognized more and more as men, they can kind of let go of all that baggage that we carry around as being perceived as women and engaging with a man as a woman. You can engage with a man as a man. You're sort of on equal footing, if that makes sense. Does that answer your question?
Well, you know, wait. Do you know any trans men that are coupled with
men?
I know trans men that have dated men, only like permanently coupled. I know they're out there, but I don't know them personally.
I've heard one theory that more trans men end up with women because what gay man would be satisfied with someone who wasn't a man originally?
No, I think there's a lot of gay men who are actually really into it. At least, judging by how much I get hit on.
Okay.
Well, you are pretty cute. Back to the interview.
Back to the interview.
How has your music evolved over the years?
Well, you know, it's kind of a tough question because most artists have the benefit of having the same voice their entire life. And so they kind of have this, they can follow their progression. I feel like I had one voice, and then there's this big wall where that voice stops and this new voice starts. And so it's really hard for me to say how it's progressed because I feel like I've literally been singing with two different voices, and this voice is very new to me.
I like your video of Rescue Me. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, Rescue Me is, Christopher and I consider that sort of the single. We're really excited about that song. It's definitely got more of a rocky R&B tinged dance feel to it. And, you know, it features Hollywood rapping on it. And we did the music video with Margaret Cho, which is really exciting to get a chance to meet her and work with her. And through a friend of a friend, she asked me if I would want to do one with her. Of course, my answer was, let me think about that, yes. And so, yeah, we had that opportunity to do it, and it was awesome.
If kids, I'm here to win, lost driving in the street. Chips, take seats, everything is the air. I'm here for good, I'm here for keeps. I play to win, lost driving.
The video kind of, in a way, sets up my next question. I understand that many trans people go stealth after they transition. From seeing your photos and video, you look totally male and therefore could easily pass. Did you struggle with whether you would be out as a trans person?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. After my EP Patience came out last August, there was a local paper that wanted to do a, they did a big article on the song. And I remember feeling, just as an artist, really excited that I was getting press and, you know, a photo was going to be in the paper and this big long article. And then the morning that the paper came out, I was standing there in my kitchen and I suddenly felt really down. I suddenly felt like, oh, great. Now the world knows. Now I'm out there. Josh is trans. You know, anybody that didn't know is gonna know now. And I started getting kind of down about it and feeling really, you know, just like, great, nobody's gonna accept me just as a man. Now there's gonna be this thing. And the more that I thought about it, though, I realized that ever since I can remember, all I've ever wanted to be was a singer. All I've ever wanted to do was be out there and you know, be a rock star, as it were. And you know what? It may not be perfect. It certainly is not what I pictured in my head when I was 4 years old. But I'm doing the best I can with what I have. I'm doing it, and a song, putting it out there, a song like Little Girl, I know that I outed myself to the world with that. I knew what kind of press that was going to generate and how people were going to, you know, what people were going to write about that. But every time I get an email from some kid or some trans man across the country that says, your song helped me today, your song changed me, your song made me feel hopeful, you know what? Forget my crap about needing to just, you know, about wanting to stay in the closet or something like that. Forget it. That's more important. What I'm doing with it is more important than staying closeted with it. I would much rather just live my life openly and honestly than strain to stay in the closet.
I hadn't written this down, but any feel for what percent of transgendered people go stealth? I mean, could that even be measured?
Yeah, I think it's impossible to measure, and I think the only way you could measure something like that is if everybody knew everybody's medical record.
If you could measure it, they wouldn't be stealth.
Right, right. I mean, I certainly know that that percentage, whatever it is much higher among trans men than trans women, because they just have so much, it's just a much harder road for them. I think there's a lot of trans guys. I mean, we can kind of spot each other from time to time, but not a lot of people spot us.
My impression is trans men pass easier than trans women.
Definitely, definitely. For the most part, we're just a little shorter and have smaller hands. But other than that, you know, you're right. I mean, because trans women, a lot of trans women, by the time they transition, you know, they've got fuller facial structure and bigger hands and bigger feet and they're taller. And that's the kind of thing that you can't change. Trans men, when we transition, our voices drop. We, you know, we develop facial hair and, you know, get more musculature. And, you know, trans women, they just don't pass as easy. It's definitely an easier process for trans men than for trans women.
How did you come up with the name of your website?
Cute Little White Guy. Because that's what I am. I wanted something that felt honest. I couldn't be a poser. I couldn't come up with something that sounded sexier than me. And I couldn't come up with something that sounded... I needed to be able to live up to it. Let's put it that way. Like this, I can live up to.
Well, I think I read, or I read between the lines on your site, that you didn't want to use your name because you want the site to represent more than just your music, because you are also interested in other things.
You did do your homework. That's right. It's not just me. but I like to work with a lot of other artists as well. Especially in the Bay Area, I work with a lot of dancers. I've worked with a number of dance companies, Sarah Bush Dance Project, Dari Leon Dance Theater, and then I've got my own dance company, Free Play Dance Crew, which is a little hip-hop company. And I like to work with basically helping other artists develop their own marketing strategies. I mean, they look at me, and I've managed to do something. I managed to get a pretty fair amount of, a good amount of press. And so what I do is I share what I've learned with other artists about how to create marketing strategies, come up with business plans, really focus what it is they're working on so that they can hopefully, achieve some success with that.
As you heard, you can find out more about Josh at his site, www.cutelittlewhiteguy.com. I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening. And I want to especially thank Coyote Grace and Joshua Cliff for the wonderful interviews. And there was so much of Josh's interview that I just could not fit into the radio version of this show. So my internet listeners can hear an extended version with a lot more comments and additional music. That, of course, can be found at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about anything music I've featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. I hope you stop by next month for part 4 of my series of transgendered artists. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. I had one more question for Josh. Tell me about the song One Life.
I really started writing it as I was at a memorial service for this wonderful trans woman that I had the privilege of working with in the Transcendence Gospel Choir. And I was sitting in this memorial service, and I really didn't have an opportunity to get to know her that well. But I was listening to all of the people talking about her, and here was this trans woman who had struggled through drugs, prostitution, HIV, all of these really, really horrible things in her life. And yet, everything I knew about her was just beautiful. Her, from her smile to the things that she chose to do with her life, like being on panels and going and talking to medical students about women with HIV. And she took a situation, her life, that was so difficult and so complicated and so hard, and managed to make something so beautiful. And that's when I started writing that song. It's a real opportunity to take something very difficult and make something really, really beautiful out of it, which I think is something that our community, the LGBT community, does all the time. We take situations where there's a lot of pain and a lot of hurt, and yet what we choose to do with it is call it pride and fly rainbow flags. And I think it's a wonderful thing. So that's why I wrote that song.
The news to me, it was magic.
been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Summer's almost over. But not quite yet. For all those interested in volunteering, listen up. At KPFT, there are two upcoming volunteer orientations following our phone volunteer training sessions. The orientation will last about an hour and is designed to give you an overview of the station and provide you with more details about our volunteer opportunities. We offer positions in the outreach team. We also need someone to operate the control board, assist in our music library, or create a PSA like the one you're hearing now, or a variety of other opportunities. The volunteer orientations are scheduled for Thursday, July 26th, at 7 p.m. and on Sunday, July 29th at 12 noon. To sign up, call 713-526-4000, extension 316, or email us at volunteer@kpft.org. This is commercial-free listener-sponsored radio, KPFT Houston.
The Ronald McDonald House of Houston offers a comfortable place to stay for families of cancer patients and other seriously ill children. Celebrate Christmas in July with KPFT and Ray Wender Entertainment to bring...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.